From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a wild world in the headlines, looming war with Iraq, disarray among longtime allies, a strange war on terror, ongoing and unresolved, signs of a fragmented world, a world straining at the multicultural mosaic Pico Iyer has written about in The Global Soul and Video Night in Kathmandu. Now, in his new novel, Abandon, Pico Iyer tackles the world's fundamental conflict of old and new, of sacred and secular, maybe of Islam in the West. Coming up on Point, Pico Iyer and the mysteries of Abandon. We begin in Washington with analysis of today's announcement that President Bush will hold a sudden summit this weekend with British Prime Minister Tony Blair and Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar. In Portugal's Azores Islands, the White House says the meeting is aimed at final pursuit of a UN resolution on Iraq. Maura Reynolds is White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her what's really going on with the Azores summit.
Well, I wish I could tell you. It's all a bit cryptic. The decision came about very suddenly in the White House last night. In fact, White House reporters had been told in the afternoon that rumors that there was going to be an Azores meeting were in fact false, that planning had stopped, and then at some point around supper time, apparently, the idea was refloated, and some phone calls were made, and then a last phone call was made again this morning, Friday morning, and they decided to go ahead. Caught us all by surprise.
Who asked for this meeting? Is this happening at the insistence or request of Tony Blair or of George Bush?
The White House won't say that it's at Blair's request. What they're saying is that it is something that has come up in the discussions between the three sponsors of the second resolution that now may not go forward in the United Nations.
And what can these three heads of state accomplish sitting on this hunk of island in the middle of the Atlantic?
Well, it's not really clear. We grilled the White House spokesman this morning, Ari Fleischer, about it, and asked that question, said, you know, these three gentlemen have been on the phone to each other most of the week. What can they accomplish in the Azores that they can't accomplish in a conference call? And we did not get a clear answer. What they say is that they felt that a face-to-face meeting would be helpful, and that the purpose of their face-to-face meeting is to discuss all final diplomatic options. That's the direct quote, but they've not given any hint what kinds of options those may be and why they must be discussed face-to-face and not over the phone.
So the formal agenda then is discussing diplomatic options would seem to suggest, or is it explicit, ways to deal with United Nations resistance? Is that the formal agenda?
Well, the mood in the White House for the last couple of days has been very pessimistic on whether United Nations approval can be gained for an additional resolution. So I'm not sure that that's the case. But the language is so cryptic that it seems to me that the agenda is probably also quite cryptic. I'm not sure there is a specific plan.
President Bush was so hard and clear in his recent press conference about the fact that he was going to insist on a vote at the UN. It's time for people to show their cards, he said. Is the White House abashed now that they haven't done that, as the president so firmly promised to do?
Well, the White House doesn't act abashed about very much. One thing that's interesting about that remark was that the mood at the White House at that time, which I presume also matched the president's mood, was that if you call a vote, some people will sort of step forward who might have been on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. That this was what happened to the administration's benefit last fall with the first resolution, that they did not know the night before that they had how many votes they had, and the next day they got 15-0, which, you know, was a great success.
Yes.
And so the mood last week very much was, we're going to push for a vote, and some of these undecideds are going to blow our direction. Well, the mood the last couple of days has not been that, and they no longer think that that will be the case, and that, in fact, the wind is blowing the opposite direction. So it is a change of policy for the administration, but when they were asked whether they're flip-flopping, they say, well, no, this is just what diplomacy is all about.
What are the issues, then, sitting on the table for Bush and Blair and the Spanish leader to address?
Well, the main one would be whether a defeat in the UN is worse than no second vote. The White House has said that we have the legal authority, the international legal authority, to go ahead based on the first UN resolution, 1441. That has not been the position of almost anyone else in the United Nations, including Tony Blair. Mm-hmm. And that's why they've been pushing so hard for the second resolution. What Colin Powell said this week is that a defeat, having explicit United Nations disapproval for military action, would be worse than the somewhat legal ambiguity that we're currently in at the present time, and that one presumes is something that the leaders will be discussing this weekend.
Is it possible, then, that this is, at bottom, a war council, not about diplomacy if that's failed, but more about last-stage planning for war?
The White House is specifically denying that that's the case. One theory that's floating around the White House these days is that it's essentially a photo op, which explains why they're flying all the way to the Azores instead of talking on the telephone about their final diplomatic options.
But what should this photo op illustrate?
Presumably that President Bush is working as hard as possible with European leaders to gain UN approval.
But he's only meeting with two and not in Europe.
Well, I believe technically the Azores are part of Europe, but it is on a U.S. air base, so I suppose that's debatable.
Okay. Anyway, this is not a summit where he's inviting the German leader, the French leader, and the whole gang to say, all right, enough with the poker here. Let's work this out for everyone's benefit.
It is a bit obscure, isn't it? I wish I knew the answer to the question why this was suddenly so important that, you know, the White House schedule needs to be thrown out the window, you know, also the three can sit in the same room.
Maura Reynolds, a final question. Does President Bush's announcement this morning that he is prepared to put forward a roadmap for peace, the famous roadmap between Israel and the Palestinians, somehow relate to the meeting in the Azores? Is it the price of getting together with Tony Blair for him to step up and be more active on the Israel-Palestinian front?
I'm not sure it's a price, but it's certainly a gesture in Tony Blair's favor. One of the most consistent criticisms coming out of Europe has been that the United States has made, you know, no movement on Middle East peace since last summer, and that they keep promising this roadmap, which will presumably lead to a two-state solution for Israel and Palestine, that this just keeps getting pushed farther and farther into the future. His statement today seemed to suggest that this is moving back to the front burner, but he did not give a specific time, and so it remains to be seen whether that statement, that vague statement of purpose, will be enough to satisfy our European critics.
And so when exactly does the president head for the Azores Islands?
It's still a little uncertain. The meeting is on Sunday, and so presumably he will leave very early Sunday morning, but perhaps Saturday night.
Maura Reynolds, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Maura Reynolds is White House correspondent with the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with us earlier from Washington. When asked why he no longer accepts travel writing assignments, Pico Iyer said this in response: "Fiction allows me to sit still, and there's an excitement that comes from not knowing what's going to come next." But armchair travelers, fear not. His fiction is as well-traveled and real as The Global Soul and Video Night in Kathmandu in his new novel, Abandon. Pico Iyer weaves a full-bodied romance between an English scholar of ancient Islamic texts and a new-agey blonde in the unlikely setting, or perhaps most likely for this tale, of sunny Southern California. It's a romance that unfolds in the midst of a deep-seated clash of cultures of 13th-century Islamic texts and today's loose-leaf love letters of scholars and surfers, Syria, Iran, and Santa Barbara, of the sacred and secular, of Islam and the West. Tonight we're talking with global observer extraordinaire and novelist Pico Iyer about love and mysticism and hot tempers in the global village. Could it be we're on the verge of war between the old and new, the sacred and the secular, dressed as Islam and the West? Is there an echo of today's international tension between speed and stillness sounding within each of us? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Portland, Oregon, is writer and world traveler Pico Iyer. He's the author of several nonfiction books, including Video Night in Kathmandu, The Global Soul, and The Lady and the Monk. In 1995, he published his first novel, Cuba and the Night. His new novel is Abandon. Good evening and welcome, Pico Iyer.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us, Pico Iyer. You're such a celebrated travel writer. Spent many days, years, and books looking at this globalizing planet that we live on. This time you chose to write a kind of mystical romance. What drew you to this format, this kind of story, with your background?
Well, I think travel writing, at least as I have practiced it, is nearly always a kind of journey towards knowledge, towards clarity. You go to a place, you take lots of notes in 2 weeks, you come back to the safety of your desk, at least I do, and then you try to bring things into a kind of order. And I wanted actually to go into the opposite direction, towards mystery, towards a sense of how much we don't know, especially when it comes to these old, deep, very complex cultures of the Middle East. Rather than going to Iran for 2 weeks and coming home to California and telling myself I knew everything about it, I really wanted to start in light and walk into darkness and get an ever stronger sense of how much lies beyond my recognition. Also, I've got to say that I think any traveler really is not somebody who's going to many places and collecting stamps in his passport, but really someone who's drawn to the next challenge, whatever is around the corner. Thoreau famously said, to travel and to descry new lands is to have new thoughts, to see new images. And I think the most exciting kind of travel for me is imagining myself into a world radically different from my own. Because I live in California and because I'm of Hindu origin, in some ways Islam is the other. And I thought I wanted to try to penetrate it imaginatively rather than just in the analytical way I've done before.
And so this time in Abandoned Pico Iyer, when you turn to fiction and you turn to mysticism, Sufism, the whole world of the Sufi, is that a kind of escape from the headlines and realities besetting us on all sides these days? Or is that in some way a more intimate address of those realities?
Intimate address is a lovely way to put it. I think it's a way of rounding out the headlines and telling myself and reminding our readers that I think the headlines tend to do justice only to one side of the equation. They stress the clash of civilizations, and they never really begin to take into account the other side of that, which is really romance between civilizations. All of us are unsettled by, even terrified of the other, the foreign, the unfamiliar, but we're also drawn into it. And I think in some ways the book arose out of my sense several years ago when I sensed that even then Washington was at war with political Islam or radical Islam, and yet at the same time the single most popular poet in America was an Islamic mystic, the 13th century Rumi. And I suppose that also played to my sense whenever I've traveled in the Middle East, the people I meet there are suspicious of, maybe hostile to the American government, but completely fascinated by American culture, drawn to American people. Many of them want to become Americans. And then I would come back to California, and my friends in California didn't want to hear much about Hafez Assad, but wanted to hear about ghazals and dervishes and carpets and all that Islamic culture has made part of the universal inheritance. And so I suppose my sense was that culture can at least begin to heal some of the divisions that politicians make. I feel that large governments are always defined by their interests and their ideologies, and they always have a sense of friends and enemies. But culturally and individually, people are wiser than that, and actually the same cultures that are at war are often in another part of themselves reaching towards one another. And so that's what I wanted to concentrate on. Although I wrote this book long before the events of September 11th, I felt that there was this nascent but always unexplored fascination between, as you were saying before, the old parts of the world and the new, and in this case between the West and large parts of the Islamic world.
And as you describe it, or as I've read you saying, Pico Iyer, you see in some way a reflection within every human being in 20th, 21st century life, a tension that maybe in some way is also being played out in these great international tensions we see right now, this old, new speed, stillness, silence, cacophony, that every individual is struggling with those things today, not only nations.
Exactly. And I think if we acknowledge it, all these divisions become a little less formidable. That's to say, exactly as you were suggesting, because I've been lucky enough to travel around a lot in recent years, although I've been watching this war between political Islam and Washington and seeing how radical Islam has certain very specific economic and political grievances with Washington and vice versa, I think the much larger and more enduring and more fundamental tension is almost between the past tense and the future tense.
Certainly, Pico Iyer, hold that thought. We've got to take a short break, and we want to come back and really dig into that. We're talking tonight with Pico Iyer about old worlds and new Islam in the West, about his new novel, Abandon. Could it be that we're on the verge of war between the sacred and the secular, dressed as the West and Islam? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Pico Iyer. We'll be right back on Point. I'm Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Pico Iyer about old worlds and new Islam in the West and his new novel, Abandon. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. What does it mean that Americans are at war with radical Islam and snatching up the Islamic poetry of the mystic Rumi? Are we each torn between the sacred and the secular within ourselves today? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pico, I want you to read a little bit from Abandon to take us into this, but it would be helpful if you'd be kind enough, just in very broad stroke for us, to give us the essential outline of the story that runs through this book and set up a bit of a reading here where you begin to talk about or your character does, about the Sufis, which play a central role in this book.
Yes, my main character is an Englishman studying Sufism in California, and at the very beginning of the story, he finds himself in Damascus and gets wind of certain manuscripts that may have gone missing during the tumult that attended the takeover of Iran by the Ayatollah Khomeini, when 500,000 Iranians left their home almost overnight, taking their treasures, their heirlooms, their carpets, and perhaps their manuscripts too, to Paris, Vancouver, but especially to Los Angeles. And so there's this exhilarated sense that if you are looking for an ancient Persian treasure today, you're more likely to find it in Santa Monica than in Tehran. And so he's dwelling on the Sufis, who are the mystical group within Islam. And one reason that I chose to center on them is that mysticism is the place where all names and divisions fall away. When you read a Sufi poem, you're in effect listening to a Leonard Cohen song, reading a Zen Koan, reading St. John of the Cross. The mysticism of any part of the world speaks to any other part. So,
in this passage, his professor, I guess, is it Sifadi? Is saying our mission is to smuggle a little bit of the Sufi light into the smog of California. Have I got that right?
Yes, and then he's sitting at his desk, and I think the next few paragraphs are just a description for those who don't know much about Sufism about what is particular. So maybe I'll read about this. He's sitting in Santa Barbara, California, by the ocean, thinking about ancient Islamic mystics.
Pico Iyer reading from Abandon.
Outside his window, the ocean was foaming and pooling around the rocks, and the summer fog erased almost everything. It gave a forlorn air to the strip of beach, as if the world had left it behind somehow and would never come back to collect it. He looked out into the mist and tried to recover the person who'd known nothing of the poets until Martine gave him the book of Rumi translations, The Last Night in Istanbul, an undergraduate's token of love. The Sufis, he wrote quickly, so called for the rough woolen gowns they wear, or suf, emblem of their austerity, their voluntary poverty, their anonymity, were a small group of Muslims who began to gather in groups, often secretly, at the beginning of the 8th century, soon after the Prophet's death. Their aim, quite simply, was to find a direct path to the divine, without the mediation of any imam or cleric. Their goal was not to conquer the world, but to conquer themselves. It was the most agonizing thing in the course, after all these years, to try to reduce the figures he'd been studying into formulae. Whatever had stirred him years ago had had nothing to do with the Islamic history he'd known nothing about, but the point of the seminar, as Sephardi had stressed, was to keep all real knowledge out of it. Pretend as if you're meeting them for the first time. Because, he wrote, they opposed everything around them, they always had the air of a secret group. In Shia countries such as Iran, they are a minority group in a minority sect that has always defined itself by its opposition to the norm. The word Shiite, as you know, means partisan. And so I might best present them to you by telling you what they're not. For the Sufi, God exists not only in the mosque or madrasa, he's everywhere, not least inside our hearts. The jihad that all good Muslims undertake, and as you also know, I'm sure the word means struggle or aspiration with none of the associations of holy war the networks always mention, the Sufi sees as internal. His goal is to suppress the infidel within. The Sufi ideal is not of love, the Sufi ideal is one of love, but it's not the love of the compassionate mother or of Jesus he speaks of. It's the ravenous, consuming eros of the lover inflamed.
And there it is, Pico Iyer reading from Abandon and laying out the outline here in his main character's words and thoughts. The whole world of Sufi, of Rumi, now, as you point out, Pico Iyer, the best-selling poet in America, 13th century Islamic mystic.
Yes, and I think to go back to that thought that I was having before, I live in Japan these days, and I spend a lot of my time in the older cultures of the world, and my sense is that those older cultures are deeply rooted in faith and tradition and community. And of course, California, more than anywhere in America, is associated with the shifting, the indefinite, the new, the whole kind of polyglot 21st century MTV swirl. Each is drawn towards the other, but there's a sense in which they're almost speaking different languages, and you were saying how it takes place in every heart, and I think this dialogue does. It certainly takes place in every family. My sense of the modern world is almost of a 16-year-old kid lording it over a group of 8-year-olds. And the 8-year-olds almost envy and admire the energy and enthusiasm of and the hopefulness of the kid, but they also feel that there's something important in the past which the kid can't begin to understand. And we're living in this curious time where the single strongest power in the world happens to be the youngest. And so, as you were suggesting before, this book is about the clash between the old and the new and between these almost non-intersecting languages, but also, as I said, about the fascination between them.
So do you see that even as we look out on the world landscape now, the machinery of war all drawn up and ready to go, can you draw a line between that conflict, between the kind of global battle that John Ashcroft stands at the podium in Washington and talks about, and this deeper, in some ways, more simple conflict between maybe old and new is too simple, but as you say, cacophony and silence, speed and slowness. Is that the backstory to a conflict being played out with such vigor on the front of the stage?
I think, yes, in some ways the backstory does have to do with people inhabiting almost different centuries and certainly different time frames. I noticed in recent times people have been thinking more and more of the famous story of how Zhou Enlai, the Chinese premier, was approached in his final days and asked what he thought of the French Revolution. Mm. He said, oh, it's too early to tell. That only finished 200 years ago. And my sense is that the Chinese, the people of my ancestral homeland, India, many of the cultures of the Middle East are working in terms of millennia, of eons. Washington and California famously is very committed to the moment and instant gratification. And I suppose a little of my concern about what's going on right now is that we're thinking in terms of what's going to happen a month from now or 2 months from now, and the people we regard as enemies are thinking in terms of 100 years from now. And it's as if the equation hardly translates from one side of the table to the other. But to go back really to the heart of your question, I think we're well advised to bear in mind this commonness reflected in the fact that people in California are actually imbibing and spoken to by Islamic poets. And when you go to the Middle East, you find that people rent out their apartments to their neighbors so that they can watch Baywatch in secret. And I think that's not because of the glory of Baywatch, but because of the fascination over there with what American promise and abundance and opportunity represents. And it seems that we should be perhaps thinking more of the ways in which we can play upon that common fascination and less about the things we don't have in common. And the other thing that my story plays upon is that the main character gets very involved with someone who seems like the quintessential Californian character, the Californian girl, in fact. And as the book develops, we see more and more that this Californian girl has a lot of Islam inside her. And so when we talk of us and them, it seems to me that has less and less meaning because us are them. The other is part of us. When you go to Los Angeles now, half the stores you see are run by people of Islamic origin. When you go to the Middle East, you see more and more people from the West. And so I don't think those old categories and the old right and wrong and right and left and old and new apply as conveniently as perhaps our politicians would like.
And yet it's not always instantly recognizable when you talk about the other here as guardians of the eternal or timeless, looking at 100 years. Saddam Hussein does not come to mind. And when we think of the blonde California girl, Islam inside her is not the first phrase that leaps to mind. How do you reconcile those?
Well, you're right that Saddam is not the first name that comes to mind, but I think a lot of those Islamic leaders, whether we're talking of the Ayatollah Khomeini or Osama bin Laden, they have a very keen sense of history, and I think they are thinking in long term, often to our cost. They're thinking of grievances that were committed generations ago, and they are so pledged to their faith that they're thinking in that sense in terms of eternities. They're prepared to take losses in the short term, as we saw, alas, on September 11th. if they think they can advance their grander cause. And I think part of the attraction of America, and especially California, has always been its freedom from history. But I think when it comes to functioning in the world, if you don't have a strong sense of the past, it's hard to have a keen sense of the future. And I think Saddam may not be thinking like that, but I'm sure Osama bin Laden and many of the other people who are ostensibly our enemies are thinking America doesn't understand the history, and so they may be strong now, but we're thinking in terms of the long term, and we have a great advantage because we have this larger frame in our heads.
Pico Iyer, there's another reading I think fits directly into this. It's a bit later in the book, to page 218, that I hope you might look to for us. But it speaks to a kind of explication of what may be going on in the mind of, I don't know, of followers even of bin Laden. You tell me, when they become completely inflamed with the desire to protect, to defend, to extend that some part of religion. Front of the book, you have an inscription from Thoreau: fire is the most tolerable third party. And fire is a kind of recurring theme throughout the book. It comes up here again in this passage. Could you set this up for us? I think, for me at least, it spoke to some kind of explanation of the over-the-top, in Western eyes, or my eyes anyway, passion that we sometimes see in religious zealotry.
Yeah, that's wonderfully said. And indeed, I, as somebody who's grown up entirely in the West, as I said, of Hindu origin, and can't imagine giving myself for any faith, wanted to try to imagine how it felt and how the world looked to someone who would die because of his love for the beloved, his beloved being a religion. So at one point in the book, a young Iranian comes to Santa Barbara, where the action is set, and delivers a short lecture on at least how he thinks the world looks through his particular Islamic eyes, and it's about why they care so much about their faith. And so this is a little bit about what happens as he delivers the lecture. The stranger was dressed in a light cotton suit with a white shirt that set off his dark eyes and thick beard, and there was nothing about him that was relaxed. He didn't smile as his host chatted with him, and even when Sephardi went up to the podium and delivered his usual encomium to the latest messiah, the man registered no hint of recognition or self-effacement. He sat, arrow straight, in the front row, and when the introduction was over, he went straight up to the lectern and began to speak. He had no notes, he gave no preamble. He just began to speak in a high-pitched, piercing voice that sounded like a flute. Sometimes, he began, you have been in love. You lie awake in the dark. You pace and pace through the night. You get up, you lie down, you comb your hair again and again. You know no world but this world, and you know no sound but the one you're listening for. And when you know this feeling, you know you will do anything for your love. Nothing is too much for you. You will protect her with your life. You are not yourself without her. You do not have interests except her interests. And anyone who threatens her, you will punish, even to the death. Please think of this. Please think of this again when you hear of suicide bombers in the Middle East or acts of terror. Please think of how you will do everything for those you have promised to protect forever. When you hear your journalists speak of our jihad and people who will shed blood to protect their temples, please think of this. Love is not the place for compromise. Who half protects a love?
Pico Iyer, reading from his new novel, Abandon. And forgive me if I've got this wrong, but it almost raises, at least poetically, something that the West describes as terrorism to a sort of love supreme.
That's right. Nelson Mandela was regarded as a terrorist in this country 20 years ago. So it shows that terrorist is a very comparative term. But yes, indeed, love supreme is a good phrase. And this man is talking about how if our wife or our children are threatened, we'll do everything to protect them. We've made that pledge in agreeing to be their husbands or wives.
But in that, then there's a kind of global threat to a certain point of view. Does that make the image of the World Trade Center towers smoking and collapsing a kind of religious image, a kind of ecstatic image? This starts to tread on a border that's very hard to follow.
It's certainly a politically incorrect thing to say, but I think the people who who flew the planes into the World Trade Centers, if we were to ask them what they were doing, they would probably say protecting our faith to the death, protecting, as you said, love supreme, protecting this eternal spirit that we will do everything to protect if we see it being assailed or undermined by people from elsewhere. It's a magnified eternal form of the way that you and I will protect the earthly spirits that we love, and that's why it's so formidable. It's what we saw with kamikaze fighters in the Japan where I live. It's what we see in many of the old cultures, even in my ancestral India, where widows will throw themselves onto the fire after their husbands die. That's just an act of devotion to a husband. But just imagine how much stronger it is if you're protecting your holy book, as I think the many of the followers of Osama bin Laden see themselves. Plays upon and perhaps corrupts that impulse. But there is something in that impulse that is strong and unanswerable.
But God help us if this is the way to resolution of the global kind of conflict or tension you described. Sam's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, that last comment has thrown me off a little bit, so let me just quickly respond to that. Mm-hmm. I called about something else. I think that, of course, it's politically incorrect, but I'm not... I think it is a bad analogy to compare it poetically with what the kind of terror at the World Center and suicidal bombing. And I'll say it quickly because just looking at someone who's doing stuff out of love and comparing some of what happened with those people where they were visiting brothels and prostitutes or the people, terrorists, who are getting paid to do it, goaded on, and they're not educated, some of them were not educated. I think that analogy is horrible for very specific reasons, but the reason I call
it, and yet maybe a kind of perverse expression of what in other circumstances is ecstatic and beautiful in the poetry of Rumi.
I think it's mythologizing something that in the details is bad and dark, but I
we
really
take that fully, Sam, but your original intent here.
My intent was really, I've read Paiko's stuff before, and I thoroughly enjoyed the book about Kathmandu. The thing he said about Sufism, the truism of said about mysticism struck me because I've just become acquainted with the Zohar, Jewish mysticism, recently, and the spirit of Sufism and Zohar is wonderfully resonant. And the question I called about was, given that there's ugliness on both sides of the spectrum that he mentions, the new, the American Democratic New, and the old world, of course, there's ugliness in India against Muslims, the Japanese racism and kind of racial almost purity that they go after. There's uglies there, and there's uglies here. I agree with that. Given that both sides have uglies and beauties, how do you somehow, what is his vision of how you get the good to somehow work over the bad?
Oh, it's a great question, the perfect question. Sam, we thank you for that and for your response to all here. We're going to have to bring you an answer after a break. We're coming right up on that. But hang on, we'll bring it to you. We're talking tonight with Pico Iyer about old worlds and new, about Islam in the West and his new novel, Abandon. You can join the conversation. Does globalization and global speed necessarily come at the expense of something older, slower, something radiant? Can all the world's dreams live in one globalized bed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back with Pico Iyer on Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Pico Iyer about old worlds and new, Islam and the West, and his new novel, Abandon. You can join the conversation. What does it mean that Americans are at war with radical Islam and snatching up the Islamic poetry of the mystic 13th century poet Rumi? Are we now each torn between the sacred and the secular, even within ourselves? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pico Iyer, our caller Sam, just before the break, put a good question forth. He said we can look at all sides, both sides, or maybe more than two sides in this now, and we can see ugliness and we can see beauty. And he's asking, after the dive you've taken into all of this, how you come out thinking about that? How do we bridge these? How do we get to the good?
There's a wonderful, wonderful question, and I have great faith in the imagination. I must say my prejudice is that our larger institutions and governments are always to some extent bound by their ideologies and interests. They have a very keen sense of friends and enemies, and that will always be the case on both sides of the world. But I think individuals have the capacity, both by traveling and by imagining, to get to know the other better and in some ways to leave off their tidy assumptions. I think one reason I travel is that when I'm sitting in California, I'll think about Syria or Yemen or other of the cultures of the world, and I figure I know everything about them. And then when I get on a plane, as soon as I arrive in Damascus, I find everything I thought I knew is wrong, and I encounter a human reality that's, of course, much more complex and nuanced than my tidy notions of what was terrible and what was good when I was sitting at home. And so insofar as we're living in a global village, and those of us in the affluent world do have a greater capacity than our grandparents ever could to see and to encounter alien cultures, both at home and by traveling, I think our first responsibility is to get to know our neighbors. And when we get to know them, we see the ugliness, as Sam was suggesting, but we also have a better chance than ever before to see the good and to see the commonness, what we have in common. I think I might have said this before, but I should really stress that I'm of Hindu origin, and one reason I wanted to explore the Islamic world is that my forefathers have been at war essentially with Islam for many, many years, and I feel the first obligation of a Hindu is to try to imagine how things look to from the other side of the street, how things seem to an Islamic person. And so as somebody who is absolutely horrified by what happened in New York and Washington 2 years ago, I was thinking, well, I have to try to imaginatively, at least to try to figure out what was going on in those heads, and having done that, to see what possibility there is of reconciliation or how to find those parts of the Islamic culture that are close to me and not just to fixate on the ones that are so horrifying to us.
So it's investigate. We're talking with Pico Iyer, travel writer and novelist. His new novel is Abandon. David's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
A couple of quick thoughts. And it's interesting to hear the talk about the old world versus the new. There's a very simple thought. The United States, which embodies the new world, got it right quickly and in a way unprecedented in human history. And it captured concepts like political pluralism, religious freedom, and other things embodied in our Constitution and our Bill of Rights that the rest of the world has latched on to the extent that it's made progress. And that galls a lot of the old world, that there's this wunderkind U.S. that has done so much in terms of advancing human history. And the old world, in many respects, is galled by that, whether it's France acting out right now or whether it is the Mideast, where there are people that truly don't represent the true tenets of Islam, as they're doing things like blowing up people in markets in Jerusalem or blowing up the World Trade Center, and to try to rationalize acts of terrorism that are out of spite is, as anything other than just that, is anathema. And we need to remember that in some of these cultures, whether it's Japan, as an earlier caller was pointing out, for incredible racism, or large parts of the fundamentalist Islamic world where the sexism is beyond anything that is imaginable, with things like veiling women and mutilating their genitals.
Yeah, we hear you. David, you make a very rich point here, and I'm eager to hear Pico Iyer's response to the whole perspective you bring to the table, which is one I think many people could respond to. Pico Iyer, how about it? David's fundamental point: the U.S. got it right, and got it right quickly, and all of this tension is about, or much of it, is about the old world being galled by that. I'm not sure that lines up with the perspective I read in your book, but you tell us.
the U.S. has got so much right. That's why I and so much of the world have immigrated to America and long to immigrate to America. But I don't think that means that the U.S. has everything right. And I don't think it means the U.S. has nothing to learn from the older cultures. And part of what's so interesting to me in this global order is that the New World, America, and especially that microcosm of the New World, Los Angeles, is ever more flooded with old cultures. If you drive around Los Angeles now, most of the people you see are from Iran and Vietnam and El Salvador and India. And so when we say it's a new world, this what America's attraction to the world has made it a different kind of place. And I just in answer to that second part of the question, we all know about the horrors of treatment of women in the Islamic world. We should also remember that there have been women heads of state in Turkey, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Indonesia. There never has been a woman head of state in the U.S. So we just have to bear in mind that things are more nuanced. I live in Japan. I'm in some ways a victim of racism as someone of Indian origin in Japan. And yet the Japanese, I must say, are among the most gracious and accommodating people I've ever met. And so I suppose I'm a believer in throwing out our easy categories, throwing out our assumptions on both sides of the world. It makes no sense for the Islamic world to demonize America. It makes no sense to me for America to demonize the Islamic world.
And yet there are traits in each that we would certainly like to move beyond.
The traits in each that we'd like to emulate, as David was suggesting well in his question.
The New York Times, when they looked into Abandon, your new novel, went right at this, I think quite related to this, right at the top, and they talk about John McMillan, the protagonist in the book, wanting to see the world in a Sufi light. He says he feels that anything can be forgiven except the longing to be better, which seems to me like the sort of American impulse, at least as laid out. He tells an English friend over dinner that he wants desperately to show that what we have inside us are not just repressed demons and all that, but something radiant, exalted. Interpret this for us, Pico Iyer. He can forgive anything except the longing to be better. Is it that there's already something exalted inside that he's saying, you're saying, the modern world is blowing past, not acknowledging?
No, there are two parts to that, I think. The first is he's talking about England and explaining why he came to America, that England is a very static, fixed society, and there's some sense in which it's very hard to grow in England, and America is the place of growth and opportunity where you can make a new self, re-script your destiny, make a new future. And that's
he's embracing this.
Yes, exactly. He's telling a friend from England, this is why I came to America, because it's a place of open horizons and where I can make myself better as I never could in England. But in a larger way, what the book is about, the reason it's called Abandon, I think, is my sense that when I'm in California, I hear a lot of people talking about being abandoned, and it's always in that very sad, therapeutic sense of being abandoned by parents. By lovers, and in some ways sometimes being abandoned by history. And in the older cultures of the world, whether it's Japan or India or parts of the Middle East, you hear a lot about being abandoned, and there it's in this classic mystical text sense of being lifted out of yourself and becoming part of something great. And so my book is an attempt to take this particular Californian sense of being stranded and without ground under its feet and seeing how it can be redeemed by exposure to some of these old traditions, and the same old traditions that are drawn to California for other reasons. And in other words, that it's a symbiosis of what happens in any romance, which is each partner learns from the other and tries to look beyond the other's deficiencies. That's the secret of any successful marriage, that you work around what is difficult and cherish and affirm the many ways in which each partner can teach the other.
And when all those Americans pick up Rumi and dive into it and so love it, then there's clearly some strong, powerful response to the allure of abandon in the old sense there.
Yes, and I think as long as we always see this as a conflict, a clash of cultures, we're stuck in this sense of opposition, this side against that side. And as soon as we look at the same situation, but think of it as a romance, remember that it's partly a romance, we're opening the door to at least acknowledging and making possible inside ourselves the chance for something more positive, acknowledging that we do have something to learn from them, and just as they have a lot to learn from us, that they and us hardly make sense anymore when so many of us are mixed up and have bits of California and bits of the Islamic world and bits of Europe inside us.
But what a difficult romance some days. My gosh. Matt's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. I started to read this book, and I was totally knocked out by the opening experience of prayer in Iran, I think, where it starts. Is that correct?
Or Damascus, I think.
Damascus.
The men with their cupped hands heavenward.
Yes.
And you know, I disagree strongly with the previous caller. I think a culture should be judged by its ability to produce people who can plumb the greatest depths of the human experience. And certainly by that criterion, Islamic culture is one of the deepest cultures that's ever been on Earth. And Rumi would say, I think, that the macrocosm just reflects the microcosm. That is, everything is going on within a human being, within the human soul. So what's externalized as conflict and battle is minimal compared to the universal conflict and battle and possibilities that are within an individual human soul.
Matt, this is Matt Glazer, the musician calling, I think.
Hey, you outed me.
I hate to out you, but you speak so eloquently, and you've been on before as a guest, and I think people might even recognize you. But
how do you, Matt,
put together the images of that truly ecstatic beauty, that depth of insight, as you say, that's, you know, beyond compare or certainly right up there with any, with the horrible headlines and the kind of faux ecstasy of death?
The world has always been a place of madness. It's just that the tools available to madmen are so much more dramatic now. So the world is a place of insanity and madness and violence. That is not new. And it's unfortunate and horrible. And yet, at the same token, what's drawing Americans to read Rumi is the chance to plumb the depths of their own souls, just why the same reason people read Shakespeare or listen to Bach. They have a sense of what's possible for them while they're on the earth, despite the madness around them and insanity around them. So to a certain extent, the internal trumps the external. Rumi says very eloquently, everything you can see is the shell of something you can't see, but that thing you can't see is the source. So if the insanity of the world, I hope, will just draw people not to become, I'm not saying to be politically inactive, to do whatever you can to make sure goodness prevails, but by the same token to reflect inward and see what this means inside your own soul.
Matt Glazer, you enrich our conversation. I'm awfully happy for your call tonight. Thanks for calling in. Pico-Iyer, and you set out the framework of this whole difficult relationship, old, new, secular, and sacred, as a romance, almost the opposite of the way it's portrayed day by day.
Yes, and I thought Matt expressed my position probably more beautifully and articulately than I could, which is just that sense that we're always reminding the Islamic world, very rightly, don't just fasten on what you dislike about America. Bear in mind all that's so wonderful about this country, which is what makes so many people want to come here. And I would say the same to here, just as Matt said, don't just fasten on or stigmatize Islam by its worst aspects. Remember its best, and remember how that best, as Matt was saying, was plays out in you. And that is indeed why I structured this whole book as a romance, because I think the nature of romance is an act of trust. You're involved with somebody utterly different, in some degree unknowable, but you decide to yourself that the potential within her or him is sufficient for you to commit yourself to that person and believe that the good will ultimately outweigh the bad. That's what every real relationship is about. And if we extend that kind of thinking to other cultures, I think we actually are the beneficiaries, and we can give that much more to them rather than closing the doors. I think in any neighborhood, it's the neighbor who slams his door and draws his curtains who's the dangerous one. The person who's trying to get to know the neighbors is making that first step towards making a better community, and that applies to the global neighborhood also.
Pico-Iyer, you've given us enough to think about tonight to keep us busy right through the weekend. It's been a tremendous pleasure. Your book, new novel, Abandoned by Pico-Iyer, brings all this romance right to the fore and puts some really compelling faces and characters to it as well. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been just great having you.
Thank you very much. I've been delighted to be on the show.
Pico-Iyer, author of the new novel, Abandoned. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Scobe. Special thanks today to John Hoder. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're